This week's episode was brought to you by Joey and the supportive listeners like you. If you enjoy The Whole Rabbit and would like to help support the show, please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where you can get all our extended episodes in an RSS feed directly to your device in your favorite podcast app, a 5x5 vinyl sticker of our cover art, and access to our Discord server, which is AOL Instant Messenger for the post-social media era. All for the donation of just $5 a month. If you want to show even more support for The Whole Rabbit, there's a $20 tier where I read the heck out of your tarot cards every month on video chat and send you a 4x4 Barrel Bunnies embroidered patch. If none of that appeals to you, then at least pick up a copy of what we're discussing on this week's episode, Robert Heinlein's ever-controversial Starship Troopers, as we compare it to the 90s action film satire classic of the same name and explore what makes each one unique and poignant today. After all, you might be surprised how much of your favorite science fiction was influenced by Heinlein's futuristic vision of the mobile infantry. In the extended episode, we discuss the hidden themes of Gnosticism and what Starship Troopers has in common with ancient Spartan society. Thank you, and enjoy the show.
If you roast beaver butt, it tastes like vanilla, because that's where they get vanilla extract from. Imitation vanilla extract.
It's the anal scent gland.
Yeah, the glands, man.
Yeah.
Are you a glands man?
No.
Man?
I guess I'm a glands.
I'm an ass woman.
You know what, though? I could never get another dog, though, because I don't ever want to be in a situation where I have to squeeze a gland.
I can do it.
Unless it's a mammary gland.
I used to be a dog groomer, and you have to squeeze the anal gland.
Or maybe a prostate gland.
That's if it's a time. Dogs are dragging their butts on the ground. It's more common that it's the anal gland than it is like worms.
It's an itching. Yeah.
Take care of your glands.
If your dog is having a healthy shit and it's large, like a normal dog, and you don't have a teacup chihuahua, then it doesn't need that service, in other words.
I've known people with very large, I guess you can have a large dog that doesn't take large shits.
Well,
I would be really disappointed in myself if I was a big dog.
It's the point of the firmness. It's not about the size, right?
Okay, yeah, I suppose so. But like, that's enough shit for today.
I think expressing an anal gland is a lot less embarrassing than having to constantly interact with other human beings while your dogs sniff each other's asses. No one has to see you do that at home. You're just like, come here, dog. Let me squeeze your ass gland.
Boy, hey, bud. How you doing?
Hey, dog. Let me smell that ass.
Yeah, it's like every time you go in public, though, it's like, oh, my dog wants to sniff your crotch. Sorry.
Some dogs do that, definitely.
Sometimes they just hump strangers and it's like, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. My dog is in heat.
Sorry.
My dog is in yeet.
Yeet.
My dog's in skeet. Skeet, 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 skeet. Goddamn. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Whole Rabbit, where we don't just ride some silly, vulnerable troop transport down to the surface so we can get blown up all at once. Nay, we shoot ourselves out of a high orbit, re-entering at free fall velocity, spreading radar scattering debris in all directions before linking up with command so we can fire ballistic nukes tactically with discretion, because this week we're discussing Starship Troopers, the Robert Heinlein classic, and the 90s action satire, which is also a classic. I'm your host, the Hacking Rabbit. I'm joined this week by Marisama, the bug-shredding Neo-Doge herself. Darth Diggis, the one and only nuke boy.
I hope they nuke Tri-State waterproofing.
And Melicor 5, the grizzled and hellish.
Hello, what's up?
The grizzled and hellish? That was totally one-sided.
Ominous.
He's got the best one by far.
And Hecka Astra, the shining laser ray of doom shimmering from the heavens as it peers down on you like the eye of Horus before all is decimated in an EMP blast that shreds your testicles.
Hello.
What kind of weird shit have y'all been getting up to? Shredding testicles.
We've been playing a lot of video games.
At first I was just going to say, I think he likes you, but he really took a left turn. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I kind of realized I had heard that Starship Troopers had been created without all of the cast knowing some of the hidden messages and meanings in it. But what I didn't know is that the novel by Robert Heinlein was fucking badass and maybe even like more entertaining.
Yeah, it was great. Like going in depth, and the scenes in the movie were kind of like how you said, or it's a satirization of the actual book in war times, the movie itself, but the book actually goes in depth, and there's a lot of details there that are really interesting.
It kind of explain and flesh out like this whole society that Starship Troopers lives in, and it's a parody of some uncomfortable propensities in our own society.
Well, that and what we could look forward to in the future, which is kind of bleak in my opinion. I mean,
yeah,
it in a way, like in a normal socialist society where everyone's united and whatever, where we go into space, you would expect, like in a normal society on Earth, you would expect the workers to be united and to run the workplace. But in this society, you have the military running everything. And if you would like to vote or be a full-fledged citizen, you have to conscript to actually have a say in the government. In this society, which
you
got
to join the military. You have to be a military veteran in Starship Troopers to vote and be considered a citizen. People who do not vote have all of the other same legal rights. They're considered legal residents. They may own businesses, but they may not vote.
This is like the extension of the military industrial complex, so like its logical conclusion.
Oh,
will we become a Spartan society and the only people who make political decisions are the ones who were willing to go to war to begin with?
Exactly. So it's sort of a self-perpetuating cycle. And this is where Heinlein gets some flack for creating a patriarchal pseudo-fascist society, whether it's deserved or not, because he makes this patriarchal moralistic society seem appealing, mostly just because it's so interesting. But we know that Heinlein, from his personal connections, was a friend of Jack Parsons, meaning he knew Thelemites and he was a sexual libertine himself, and it would be unfair to call him a fascist or his beliefs fascist. Although it was his response to, I believe, the suspension of nuclear testing, which prompted him to write this novel.
Tension from the Cold War, I think, and whether like communist, military style, or like capitalist, how we do here in the States. Pretty much Russia versus U.S.
Well, in 1958, he was writing A Stranger in a Strange Land, and then they shut down a couple of nuclear testing facilities. So he actually put Stranger in a Strange Land on hold in 1958 and wrote Starship Troopers in just a couple of weeks. And then when he finished Starship Troopers, went back to finishing Stranger in a Strange Land in 1959.
So he wrote Starship Troopers as a bit of a political message, but it had to do with technology in general and the future of technology and how it would be used with the military. While we discussed before the show, they had power suits before Heinlein's Starship Troopers. It was during this novel where the idea of the badass soldier, like just a marching death machine, bulletproof with nukes strapped to him and jump jets and pretty much an invincible walking juggernaut.
Master Chief, the Doom Guy.
Oh, Doom Guy. Yeah, exactly, dude.
The kids these days call him Doom Slayer.
Samus,
that's true. Yeah, fucking.
That's probably a lot closer to how the novel describes how badass the suit is. I mean, Samus has like the best suit of armor. Yeah. Yeah.
So they describe it as like godlike.
Yes.
Yeah, because
little mini nukes and like honestly, like their grenades aren't just little grenades. Like they blow up portions of towns.
And they're like they're expected to use it too. Like they don't want you coming back with like a bunch of unused ammo. Like,
yeah,
it makes sense that they would put females in the suits too, because they're good pilots in the novel and in the film.
Well, they don't really mention the females being in the suits
in the novel.
No, they don't.
But they also in the movie they don't have the suits at all.
No.
They don't.
That's the most disappointing part of the film.
Yeah,
I know.
I thought that fucking football armor they wore was like the fucking
they got the helmet and shit, but not.
They would have been able to go hand to hand with the bugs in the movie if they had their fucking suits.
Yes.
I wanted to see some ripping and tearing. That's kind of disappointing.
Oh, man, the book, I think, is way better than the movie just because of the suits. Like, that alone makes it amazing.
Yeah, agree.
He explains the difference between the powered suits and what we see in the film. In fact, they talk about the soldiers that fight in those suits is like lesser than, because they arrive in troop transports the same way that we saw in the film. But in the novel, the mobile infantry drops orbitally in these giant drop pods that are not unlike the H.R. Giger painting, where they're shot out of a bullet, essentially. And it's a terrifying thing to get into a drop pod, because you shoot one at a time, you essentially become human cargo, and you might not even know if your ship is like knocked out of commission or they forget to fire you. You can die in there. And then you have to drop like free fall speed with like 10 G's on you, and you re-enter. And when you do, you scatter like all this debris that causes like radar scattering, and it confuses the enemy. It makes it very difficult to see where you are discreetly. Once you land, you're all alone. You have to link back up with your command using your high powered radar and communication techniques. And then you can start launching like the tactical nukes. And well, in the book, there's one scene where he like rips into a building. There's a whole bunch of what he calls skinnies. And he just like drops a timed bomb that's like, this bomb will explode in 30 seconds. This bomb will explode in 29 seconds. And all the skinnies are like, oh, fuck. And they all like scatter out of the building and the bomb explodes. It's just, they're like these unstoppable death machines.
Is it even worth trying to run away from it?
That's what they're testing. I don't know. It was a test weapon in the, because in the beginning of the book, they come in and they're doing a raid on a skinny civilization or an outpost or something. The protagonist uses three handheld nuclear launched warheads, where he uses a laser to paint the target just like in StarCraft, but it shoots out the barrel of his gun and it travels and travels and it'll blow up like an entire like city block or an entire like facility.
Oh, like a scud.
Even at the beginning of the book, he's like describing being shot out in a pod. He's describing it very much like being a bullet waiting in the gun to be shot, and you can hear the bullets ahead of you getting shot, and those
thunk,
yeah
thunk.
And those are other individual pods being shot out, and each pod has a trooper in it.
He could even hear the pod that doesn't have a trooper in it, and it sounds different.
Yeah,
these guys are trained so well.
Also in the book, there's like this profound like darkness and panic and not knowing if you're like gonna die. Like, what if the ship gets shot down and you're stuck there?
Yeah.
And you,
this is really
so he talks a lot about that in the book, whereas I think it's the movie is so fast paced that it doesn't do that, and there's a lot of technology that's omitted, you know, in the movie.
This is how World War II veterans describe the feeling of waiting on a boat at D-Day and then seeing the people ahead of them get shredded.
I think something the book has that the movie doesn't have as well is like they touch a bit on the psychic stuff in the movie, but they don't really talk about all of the hypnotic stuff that the book talks about.
Yeah, like Carl in the movie, he's basically a graduate with Rico and the other two girls that are the stars of the movie. But in the book, Carl, he becomes like almost like a Secret Service agent because he trained with psychic ability, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they put him in the upper echelons because he could, and at the end of the movie, you'll see he actually can contact different like non-human entities with his powers.
Is this the Neil Patrick Harris character?
Yeah.
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 Other people in the book, which I thought was interesting, is Rico did lots of interviews with different parts of the infantry and like servicers. And he put down, oh, I had a dog when I was a kid. I like dogs. But he had like a rich person's dog where it was like a poodle, like a lap poodle. And he didn't have any kind of, he didn't raise it. His parents did. So when he went to the interview in the book, it was interesting because they were going to interview him to be a symbiote for a Neo dog for the infantry, which is like a higher ranking soldier. And they have a canine unit that's basically, they can understand how it talks and they probably have a psychic link with it.
Yeah, I think it's suggested that they have like a psychic connection with their dogs. And that's why like if one goes down, it's like it's more humane to kill the Neo dog if the master goes down.
It's very interesting. It's like a psychic link that they make, and they're so entwined with each other that the one and the other are independent, are dependent on each other. But they make great, like, the dog will actually, like, sniff out things, and they have some kind of...
Do things that dogs do?
They can explode on shit, which is kind of fucked up. Apparently, this happens a lot, where the dog will die and the human survives. And it takes about 6 months to a year or more for those people to survive their dog dying.
So the Neo dogs are introduced in the novel. When Rico is trying to get placed in the military, he picks all of his supposed dream jobs. And the second to last one that he chooses is about Neo dogs, because he kind of likes dogs. And then the one underneath that is mobile infantry. When the placement guy starts asking him about dogs, like, did you used to have a dog as a kid?
Did you let him in your room and sleep on your bed? And he was like, no, of course not. Mother and father would never approve of that.
Then they're like, well, you're probably not fit to be a symbiote with a Neo dog because you have to be very close with your dog. He says that it's on par with being married. In fact, he asked him, like, have you ever been married? Because it's like that. It's like the connection you have with a spouse. And then if the Neo dog dies, they basically, like, put you in a coma and rehabilitate you for 6 months. Like you said, because it's so tragic. And then
you have to go to rehabilitation and, like, psychiatric rehabilitation.
The recruiter kind of makes fun of him in the book a little bit too, because he's like, you couldn't even sneak your dog into your bedroom past your mom, like,
yeah,
you don't deserve a Neo dog.
Yeah.
I have a pop quiz. I just want to see, do any of us remember the names of the four main characters? I'm pretty sure Mari called Rico the psychic guy, but I know the psychic guy wasn't Rico.
No, Rico's Carl. The main character. Carmen is also in the book as well as the movie.
She's the pilot. She's the pilot.
You don't hear a whole lot more about her in the book. They made her like a key figure in the movie. And Carl is also another recruit at the beginning of the book as well as in the movie. He's the SS looking dude. He looks kind of Gestapo near the end.
In the movie.
Yeah, and he's the one who goes, it's a fray! Yeah!
Well, he has enough psychic ability to control a weasel. Sort of like what we would assume with the Neo dog. But he doesn't have it because of a connection with the weasel necessarily. He's just profoundly psychic. And then we see him being used in that capacity for psychic warfare, which in the novel is handled by civilians, weird civilians, that Rico at one point says, are we okay with this kind of black magic? Because they don't even know how they're using it. And so it's like Heinlein suggesting at that time that the Nazis were into some weird psychic stuff, that the commies were into some weird psychic stuff, and that we were too. But he doesn't really go into it. It's just introduced. It's interesting that we see this same thing reflected in StarCraft and in the Warhammer universe.
It is my dream to kill a goat by staring at it.
Apparently it's possible, because that film is supposed to be based on what actually happened in the military. Like, the U.S. military and the Soviets messed around with psychic warfare, and they got some good results. Although, it was mostly in conjunction with traditional information gathering techniques where it was the most useful. So it's not that spectacular, to be honest.
Yeah, as far as I understand, they did get results, but the results weren't consistent enough for combat situations. Like, combat situations, they need, like, 90-something percent effective tactic, and they were, like, way below that.
Is anybody else?
They were using psychics in World War II to find the locations of submarines and stuff. And in the novel...
Well, that's true.
In the novel, they have this one... it's closer to the end of the novel when Rico is on the planet with the bugs. And they have this one, I guess, civilian come down and kind of like psychically read where the bug tunnels are underneath the surface. And this is what he refers to as black magic in the novel, because he's like, is this map reliable? Like, this dude just basically came out and like stood around for a bit, told us all to freeze and do nothing. And then suddenly we have this map of all these bug highways.
That's what the Nazis did. You're totally right. And that actually is a bit like the film where they're portraying the humans a little bit like Nazis.
Yeah, totally.
Well, also...
And the bugs would be, you know, Jewish people.
Well, also, Carl sends Rico a message psychically to rescue the stranded soldiers or soldier, that the only one that survives, right?
I feel like that would be really weird and uncomfortable to get a psychic message from somebody.
Well, he
like,
saw
I don't know, unless you're just that kind of friend with him. But
that sounds like a conversation for another time.
This is a related topic, though, and it's not considered black magic in the Starship Troopers universe. They use very sophisticated hypnotism, where even in the novel, the main character, Rico, has been implanted with post-hypnotic suggestions, just like everybody in the mobile infantry, to sleep on command. There's even a scene where he's saying to his superior officer, before I go to sleep, can I go check this one thing and this other thing? And then his superior officer's like, dude, you've been asleep for an hour. And Rico's like, I have? Because they are trained to go to sleep on command and wake up fully alert. In theory, this is something that is possible and has been used in the military, maybe specifically by Hassan E. Sabah's assassins, which is sort of a Easter egg in the novel because there is an assassin named Hassan. It's also a popular topic for Robert Anton Wilson to bring up.
I'll have to dig up the video if y'all want to see it later, but I have absolutely seen a video of a guy who was went to sleep on an AC-130 preparing to drop. I think they were paratroopers or something, right?
Yeah.
And then somebody next to him kind of just starts fucking with him while he's asleep. And he's sitting up straight. His head's just kind of slumped over, you know? I think he touches his gun. I think he touches his pistol. And basically, immediately, as soon as that pistol is even slightly unsettled in its holster, he wakes up, grabs it out of his holster, racks the slide without even looking in his direction. he just opens his eyes and he's ready to fucking go. And then he glances at him after he does all that, and he puts it back and goes back to sleep.
That's exactly what we're talking about, but that being part of the training.
Yeah, they're fucking you up. It's like joining the French Foreign Legion, but in space. They can do whatever they want to you while you're training.
And I suppose everybody that votes in this society has that expectation of people.
That is a funny thing to consider, that the only people that have a right to vote in Starship Troopers may have been hypnotized with post-hypnotic suggestions, which leads me to want to defend Heinlein, as he's usually accused of creating some patriarchal fascist society, as I mentioned earlier, and making it seem like a good option. When if you want my opinion, it sounded like he was more into the technology. He was friends with Jack Parsons and he believed in futurism, but it's unfair to do what most people do and call Star Trek a socialist utopia and Starship Troopers a fascist dystopia, or perhaps utopia for some weirdos, because they're both very similar in a lot of ways. In reality, both societies delegate a great deal of decision making to the military, have unalienable rights for civilians. They both have private property in their universe, private business enterprise, and both might be considered liberal societies. But in Starship Troopers, you have to join the military to vote. I would imagine in Star Trek everybody can vote. But then again, if you're on the fucking USS Enterprise, and you don't get to vote if you fight Klingons that day. Like Picard decides, the captain decides. In fact, he's been trained to take the lives of all those civilians in his own hands and take responsibility for them as a military man. So it's really not fair to call Star Trek some socialist utopia, when honestly, there's quite a bit that's the same.
Like even what you're saying, the owning of private property. In Star Trek, Picard's family owns a vineyard, that's kind of a repeated theme, actually. You see like several people that are in higher positions that own property in the Star Trek universe.
So it's not a socialist utopia. It's just not.
It's high tech, and that's what's cool about it. Join Starfleet.
So what is, I just watched the movie, I didn't read the book, but what is necessarily socialist about it? I know there's an emphasis on the fact that
this is fascist.
Men and women are seen.
That's what people mistake it for, is fascist utopia, but it's just like how fascist Star Trek is. It's just the
same. There's not much economically different from, you know, modern day America in this movie.
Right.
At least demonstrated.
In every Star Trek, they like break protocol too. Like they always end up breaking the prime directive.
Well, yeah, he definitely has done that before and paid the price. And he's like, you know what? I'm Picard. Fuck you. I got my ship. I'm out of here.
But like on the ship, he's the captain. Like,
yeah, he is a military dictator of his ship. And unlike Starship Troopers, he has actual civilians with him, Where in Starship Troopers, that would be unthinkable.
Right. He's like hauling his slaves around with him.
Yeah, and using him as collateral or even as...
This is why I fight.
Well, and they don't get to vote. None of the civilians on the Enterprise get to vote.
Yeah, I don't feel like fighting Klingons today, Mr. Picard. I vote not to. Excuse me, no, I'm the military dictator of this ship. Where, okay, and even in Starship Troopers, like, if you decide you don't want to fight that day, nothing happens to you. You just don't get to vote, and they pay you out, and you go home.
It's very corporate.
It is very corporate.
And so, that's actually interesting, too, because it... Are we talking about politics yet?
Yeah,
we're in it.
A key feature of fascism is the blending of corporate and state power. It's like if you think of Nazi Germany, the government appropriated a number of corporations and used them for their purposes.
Well, it's been said that the film has elements in it that are based on America's Why We Fight and Nazi Germany's Triumph of the Will. It's pretty clear to see. I think it's a little bit more like Why We Fight, because in Starship Troopers, it's like, this is why we're fighting. We got these bugs, but we're going to beat them with this. And that's a lot like what America's film is like.
Frame for frame and almost word for word, it's copying like both of those movies at the same time.
I think it's interesting too that the aliens are specifically bugs. By the way, this is my favorite line in the whole movie. It's when they have two soldiers that are just like, one's an anchorman and one's a cameraman, and they're escorted by an armed squad of people who are good enough to keep them safe even while they die. And the best line in the movie, the anchorman yells at the camera, "This isn't a normal planet. It's a bug planet. It's a planet inhabited by bugs." And then I think after that, he gets his shit fucked up, like he gets impaled or something.
Yeah, the gore in this was great when it came out.
Oh, it's delicious. Heads fall apart. I mean, like, fall apart, like even in the training scene. But so it's interesting to me that they're bugs, though, because we already, like, everybody already kind of hates bugs to a certain extent. So you're primed to be disgusted by them. Also, they're green.
In the novel, they're explained as being biologically communist, that they're biologically Marxist. They have one soldier per 50 workers. And in fact, most of the time in the novel, the aliens that are there aren't even able to attack. It's mostly just workers. I think this is part of the satire of it. And then the bugs see themselves as expendable. Whereas just like the humans, they have a brain class, they have kind of a royalty class, but the soldiers and the workers are expendable. And in this way, both in the novel and in the film, it's a satire both of the military, but it is calling the bugs communist in both.
In StarCraft, there's a worker class, and all they do is just harvest minerals and bring them back. They can't really fight. But you can kill them, and boy, do you kill them. And even in the novel, the Rico kills some workers, and it's like, well, they're in the way. But workers are part of the Marshall Society, but they're probably the lowest on the tier, as usual. But they can't fight, and that's the point, is that in a Marshall Society would be a society where you're valued on how strong you are, or how willing you are to kill or fight for the nation. And that's where you're talking about, like, we're going to talk about Sparta. Sparta was based around this very concept.
And how fascism utilizes aspects of the population to serve war, and how your value is based on you being a warrior. How in Starship Troopers, you have to be a veteran to vote. So we could say that even though it's a liberal society, it is a martial one.
Yeah, and the propaganda too. In the fucking movie, the propaganda is amazing because it really shows they have to hype people up to get them angry enough to fight like a beehive. Like they're trying to emulate the insect, but humans are never perfect at that, right?
Even in the book, the bugs use like a tactic where they use the workers as like a kind of expendable thing. So there's one part where they get swarmed by workers and only workers, and it's used as a distraction tactic by the bugs.
Yeah.
So the bugs are just throwing workers after workers, being like, whatever, just to kill off the workers.
They're expendable.
Draw their attention to one place because they're expendable workers.
And that mindset's great because it's like a reverse form of violence. It's like allowing the violence to happen because you can. Like, okay, these distractions will just be like, I can see them all dead. I can see all those units dead. And like my real mission is going to be accomplished by some other way.
That gives credence to the brain bug theory, which in the movie, it and even in the novel at some points, civilians that think the bugs have a brain and can think, or that there's at least one bug that can do that, they're labeled like Alex Jones, like a conspiracy theorist. Whereas in the military, they already know there's like a brain bug that controls the lower units, like the workers and the soldiers. So they're coordinated in a way where the workers will actually kamikaze themselves as a distraction, like you were saying.
It makes sense to relate the humans to the bugs, even in the novel, because the humans only overcome the bugs by studying their strategy and how that strategy would make sense to them.
Like, or
the
emulating reason that, it.
And they're emulating it. Like, they're doing something that they can understand. Like, well, they're going to be using the worker bugs as distractions, and then whenever they use many more soldier bugs, that's because their back is against the wall, and we can assume that they have the soldier bugs coming out of holes where their brain class is. So we don't even want to kill the soldier bugs. We want to capture the brain class, which is a lot like how you would wage modern warfare in the human world. Heinlein isn't just saying that this military society, as badass as it is perfect. He is relating it to the bugs, but he's doing it in a different way than they do in the film. In the film, the humans borrow a bit more from liberal society, you could say, and they could even be considered like a satire of communist or Marxist ideas, where in the novel, not so much. So I think it would be unfair, once again, to call Star Trek like a socialist communist utopia when the Borg have been created in Star Trek to serve as the satire of communism, because even though the Borg are considered like this multicultural race, they all have like that hive mentality that's been built into them, which is not unlike how the Zerg operate in StarCraft.
So, like, if for anyone who's not familiar with Star Trek, the Borg basically, like, they function by taking prisoners, basically, and then turning them into Borg with implants. And then all of these newly acquired Borg soldiers, they all get their instructions from essentially a hive mind. So they're all thinking the same thing. They all get treated the same way. They're fairly, I guess, expendable, except when they die, they retrieve the equipment that was attached to them.
The technological implant, right?
Yeah, and they have a Borg queen.
Well, that's interesting because the Zerg, they're much like that, except they utilize purely ecological and biological warfare. The species itself actually has a sec that regulates and positions the horde to actually go after genetic material that will make them more diverse.
Yes.
Like
and
the then, Borg.
And then, the Borg kind of do that by taking technology from the races that they take over.
But the Zerg take over a planet and the hierarchy, the queens, and then there's a Overmind and a Cerebrate that they direct the troops to attack. And basically, once a Zerg attacks and kills something, it absorbs the genetic material of that victim. And the Hive understands the genetic material. And then the upper echelons have access to it and they can make new eggs. I mean, we're used to mating with things, right? We're not used to killing people to take their genetic material.
Well, that's kind of like something that bugs do, like when praying mantises, after they get done fucking, or I don't even know if you could call it fucking, whatever they do.
Feed the baby.
You know? Yeah, but it's similar. You know, you just entwine the death into life.
Yeah, you're taking their genetic material and then killing them. That is very bug-like.
Yeah, I think that's what the brain bug does in the movie, too, and that's a great scene when he sucks that dude's brains out.
Yeah. Half-Life. Yeah.
Oh, dude.
That's
totally.
That's a Half-Life thing, too, yeah.
The don't go to Ravenholm level with the head crabs. You end up looking like one of those things in the movie.
Well, fucking Alex's dad, I forget, just the guy that reminds me of Morgan Freeman or Denzel Washington, I don't know. fucking the way he dies in the series is that he gets I forget what they call him, a monitor, whatever. It's like
the Shalula toy.
Yeah, the big fucking worm things that control the combine.
The highest rank of the combine. Yeah, they're like pure intelligence, and they could do magic, and
they have a proboscis, and they can eat brains. And the guy gets his brain eaten with a proboscis that penetrates the back of his skull.
The scene in the movie is great, though. Like, the special effects on the dude's face. It's just like, wow.
Well, he also drew it out. That's
I can't believe I totally forgot about that. Yeah, I mean, it's like, it slurps up some fluid along with a brain for like a good 5 seconds.
Yeah, it's pretty gross. And that brain bug looks like a baby, too. It looks weird. It's all soft-headed and
like
round.
It's like a larva, which...
It's got a bunch of big eyes.
Queens usually
almost human-like.
Like. Queens usually have a larva-like appearance.
In both the film, excuse me, let me start over. In both the novel Starship Troopers and StarCraft, the bugs are expendable, but the humans are not. In fact, in StarCraft, you can repair and heal up all the Terran units in one way or the other, much like you would expect in Starship Troopers, because for each soldier, it costs them $500,000 in training and equipment to make one. Whereas the bugs are just seen as expendable. Likewise, we see the same thing with the humans in the film. The humans are seen as expendable. And so here's the main difference between the film and the novel. In the novel, the humans are a step removed from the liberal utopia dystopia, and they are a step towards the more patriarchal militaristic one. And in the film, the humans are portrayed a little bit more with like a left-wing dystopia, or how do I say this? The image portrayed of the humans in the film is making fun of the radical left as well as the radical right. It doesn't just it hits on both, and it does this through the equality of the women and the other races, which is not exactly the same as the novel. In fact, in the novel, they separate the men and the women. It's understood that the women have better reflexes, and so they make better pilots. But the men are seen as stronger, and so they make better soldiers. And they're separated by sex. So when a male soldier, you know, looks at a female, it's like he's looking at some mythical being.
Yeah, they like joke about it. And they joke about it in the book, basically being like, they haven't seen a female in like years, and they're starting to wonder if they even exist anymore. They're like a mythical creature, which is not the same in the movie.
Not at all.
In the movie, they're just all lumped together.
Yeah, they're taking showers with like their tits out.
Yeah.
With, you know.
Oh yeah, that scene.
Yeah, I like that scene.
I do too.
Girls are simply wonderful. Just to stand on a corner and watch them going past is delightful. They don't walk, at least not what we do when we walk. I don't know how to describe it, but it's just more complex and utterly delightful. They don't move, just their feet. Everything moves in different directions, and all of it graceful. That's Heinlein saying that.
It sounds kind of like he's just describing like an old cartoon walk cycle, though.
So they're equal under the law in the Heinlein novel, but they're seen as different. Biologically and even complementary, they're not considered equal. Where in the film, that's part of the satire, is this military structure, which is bug-like, has placed the men and the women in this like uniform caste. Like, there is no difference between a man and a woman. They're the same. There is no difference between any of the races. They're all the same. And it does it to the exclusion of okay, for instance, like you have a scene where a white man is being whipped by a black man.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Oh, that was great.
This is sort of subtle, but in the shower scene, a black woman who's talking to a white woman has an interaction like, well, why are you joining the military? And why are you joining the military? The white woman with the short hair says, well, I'm joining because being franchised will make it easier for me to be a mother. Because it'll allow me to get a license easier to have a kid. Which, like in Demolition Man, which is a leftist dystopia, you have to have a license to breed. Okay? And the black woman says, oh, well, I'm going into politics.
She kind of laughs at the white chick, too. Like, oh, like, you want to have a family. Like,
you wanna,
I'm going in for politics.
She's being macho about it, for sure.
Yeah.
So they're pointing out how this human militaristic structure is anti-tradition and that it makes men and women the same. And it's pointing that out in that scene. Also, there's a scene where a black woman punches a white male just because of something that she didn't like to hear. Where in real life, that would be a complicated, like, cultural, like, racial interaction.
People would be angry on Twitter for months.
Yes.
And then you get, like, weird asses debating it with, like, on videos with a 500,000 view count.
I think it's also worth noting that the same black woman from the shower scene who wanted to go into politics, she ducks out after the training exercise where the one dude gets shot in the head and dies. She ditches out after that. And it's kind of, I think, like a subtle statement of like people getting into politics that aren't even willing to do any kind of like hard work or put themselves on the line for the sake of the people. Like this chick wants to get into politics, but she's not really that serious to put herself on the line in that universe for the people. So it's kind of a statement about politicians in general.
Yeah, I dig that.
So essentially the humans are more bug-like in the film, where Heinlein takes a bit more to massage the idea that humans are unique, that it might be the reason that humans lose the war is because they don't want to leave anyone behind. And that this is something that's in human religion, this notion that, well, if you have a flock of 99, you go leave them to find the one missing. And that this is what makes humans special. And possibly the separation of the sexes it plays into that and how they're complementary. Unlike the bugs, which are all mechanized and perfect. So this is something that's portrayed very differently in the film versus the novel. Probably the biggest difference, in my opinion. Well, for instance, there's a scene in boot camp where a woman and a man spar each other, like full contact. And the drill sergeant just beats the shit out of the woman. There's another scene where I think that's the one I'm talking about, basically, where in Heinlein's novel, that would be inappropriate for a man to beat the hell out of a woman, even in a military setting. Whereas that's more like bug-like. That's more like the Borg.
It's also interesting because I think that's a cultural artifact of the different times that the book and the movie were produced. Because in the late 50s, it was still pretty much unthinkable to do that to a woman, unless you were married to her and it was behind closed doors.
Yeah, then we have the rule of thumb where you can beat the shit out of your wife as long as you don't do it with something wider than your thumb.
Yeah, and as long as you're wearing a belt. I don't know. I've seen a couple of them with full fists. I'm pretty sure they didn't care. Just as long as you didn't kill her. Anyways. Yeah, and in the movie, they don't give a fuck.
It's ignored to the point of satire, basically. So like in the... Go ahead.
And do you think they use the ones without any limbs and no eyesight as paperweights?
Actually, the things that they find for people to do are pretty gruesome. They suggest that if you don't make it into some sort of active fighting role, that you could end up field testing equipment on Titan. And oftentimes the testing equipment doesn't work and you could just die alone on Titan.
Cool. I wish that would happen to me.
So I think this ties into like the perceived value that Heinlein goes into in the novel. So he's basically made a point of saying like there's a perceived value to the vote, and that perceived value is that the vote is powerful. And with that power, you have to balance your authority with responsibility. So anyone who's wanting to vote gets placed in basically what the maximum capacity is that they can handle in relation to their skill set and their physical abilities and whatnot. So like, even if you join and you're in a wheelchair, they're still going to run you like a dog so that you can earn that vote. And you sign up for a minimum 2 years. That's in the contract, in the oath that they swear.
I feel like if you go in a wheelchair, you do not come out with biceps smaller than your head.
Yeah, they're going to run you like a dog. Like, regardless of what your capabilities are, you have to earn that vote, because that perceived value of the vote is so high. Because when you exercise your vote, you're basically deciding for the rest of humanity. That's a very large responsibility and authority that you're exercising. So you have to work for that.
They got to make you excited about sending young people to war so more people can vote.
Well, and like, how much do you care about your fellow man that you're willing to basically sign away 2 years of your life for rigorous work to decide what should happen for all of your peers around you? Like, these are things that Heinlein wants you to think about. And he goes through great lengths in the novel to kind of explain just how important that value of vote is. He talks a lot about how our morals are set as well. Socially, like that our morals are based in survival instincts.
And that survival is determined by violence, and violence is the supreme authority over everything, because it ultimately does come down to survival. And the vote is symbolic of this. Quote, when you vote, you're exercising political authority. You're using force. And force, my friends, is violence. The supreme authority from which all other authorities are derived.
What is a government but a monopoly on violence?
The idea is that the government has the ability to enforce its will through violence, and hopefully that this will is in alignment with the collective good. But we all know in real life it doesn't always work that way.
But at least, like, in Heinlein's universe, like, to be a politician, you have to forfeit 2 years of your life and work like a dog. Like, how badly do you want that authority? How you have to learn how to balance that. He talks about responsibility balanced with authority. So every politician in this Starship Troopers universe has had to go through this rigorous training. Like, you would never find that in the... like in the president or a prime minister, like they would never go through boot camp training and like on the ground and stuff. Like they don't give a fuck. They're basically desk job politicians now. But in the Heinlein universe, like they actually have to go through all of this crazy shit just to become a politician. And they only really show a little bit of that in the movie. And the one chick that's interested in politics, she ducked out. She was like, no.
Yeah, when somebody actually died. And so they believe in the novel that this is the one thing that has allowed humans to succeed is by recognizing this responsibility and relating the idea of the vote to force. That's something that should only be relegated to people who have been willing to sacrifice their personal needs for the collective survival. Do you think that's true or not?
I'm doing my part.
Like, I think that people need to be handed the answers so much that if they're made to ask themselves a question of this level, they just give up and will accuse Heinlein of being a fascist. Because there's a lot of spoken in the novel in criticism of our current society. They say that in the 21st century, things became like they did in Clockwork Orange or Demolition Man. Crime has taken over everything. And it's because they gave too many people the ability to vote. And that there is no such thing as a juvenile delinquent, because a delinquent means somebody that is ducking out on their responsibility. But a juvenile doesn't even know what their responsibility is yet. And so they have all these like supposedly enlightened ideas about morals, and they feel that they can be verified mathematically. For instance, in one section, it's used in this context. Would somebody read this?
Both for practical reasons and for mathematically verifiable moral reasons, authority and responsibility must be equal. Else a balancing takes place as surely as current flows between points of unequal potential. To permit irresponsible authority is to sow disorder. To hold a man responsible for anything he does not control is to behave with blind idiocy. The unlimited democracies were unstable because of their citizens. We're not responsible for the fashion in which they exerted their sovereign authority. Other than through the tragic logic of history, no attempt was made to determine whether a voter was socially responsible to the extent of his literally unlimited authority. If he voted, the disastrous possible happened instead, and responsibility was then forced on him willy-nilly and destroyed both him and his foundationless temple.
And so this is the idea that not only should everybody vote, but only certain people should be allowed to vote. And they even mention how in societies where everyone is forced to vote, some people will still try and not vote, or will give their vote to somebody else.
This reminds me a lot of like when you go into a store and it's like, I don't know, I just work here. Like, I don't know, just ask the manager. Like, I don't want to vote. I don't want that responsibility. Some people just straight up don't want that authority.
Some people get really pretentious about it too, and go on to say that by voting you are directly taking part in whatever wrongs go on. Never mind the fact that by not participating, you may be allowing the worst of two evils to come into existence.
And then on the other hand of it, you might have people that are only voting for themselves out of greed and aren't thinking about the rest of the population. And those people are kind of weeded out in Starship Troopers. If you're a me, 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 you're not going to go through 2 years worth of rigorous training being worked to the bone, you know?
Unless you're a real monster.
They make it really easy to leave, you know, to like abdicate your duty. They make it very easy. So that they weed out those people.
Yeah, and so that's what he's talking about with perceived value as well.
Yeah, like how, like, it's addressed. How much is something really worth? You know, is everybody's labor equal? It doesn't how much you personally want something factor into how much something else is worth? And that market value is merely just an average or, you know, a determination attempting to approximate that. But really, value is something that's intensely personal. And it's something that is tied to the individual. Like, it's subjective. It's a subjective thing, value.
Yeah, like, if you're at work and you, like, do a way better job than, like, another person does, you can't say that you both do equal work.
Even in, like, the broader, more logical sense of value, value is typically defined by how many people want something in particular, as in supply and demand, you know, and if you try to quantify why they want that thing, it'll come down to, you know, any number of different reasons, particularly if it's some kind of form of media like a movie or a video game or music. Why is the pop industry today more leaning towards EDM and not rock music or hip hop like it used to? It's just supply and demand.
Yeah, if you want the vote, how badly do you want to vote? How badly do you want to be a citizen?
And it reminds me of what I was mentioning before we were recording about free will. You know, how valuable is your free will? And does it even matter? You know, or should you just kind of grow up and start doing your job? It's kind of like how the soldiers do. You know, they know, they realize that it's a duty. They believe it's a duty to go out and do what they do and to earn that right to vote and whatnot. So it's kind of a mix of like giving up your free will for like this program that they got you in or something.
Well, you have to make a sacrifice for society before you can participate in it.
In the form of voting, which is seen as violence, where you could still own a factory or a vineyard or whatever, but you can't ever vote.
A lot of people in this society are content with that, and that's demonstrated from the beginning that, you know, not every kid from their high school goes on to join the military. His rival in space football just steals his girlfriend and leaves.
Yeah.
His parents desperately do not want him to join the military.
His dad ends up joining.
Yeah, his dad ends up joining, but he was very upset that Rico joined, just like in the film.
What a bitch. I would feel very uncomfortable if my dad followed me into the military. I'd be like, what the fuck?
I think you're supposed to feel that way. In my opinion, that's where the book, the satire, is much more apparent, where he's like, oh, my daddy joined the super patriarchal society, and now we're like brothers, and we can talk to each other. And then he's late to his...
Yeah, and I'm just trying to suck the Navy captain's cock the entire time.
Basically. I don't... See, and like, is there room for homosexuality in Heinlein Starship Troopers? Like, that's another question. Like, would they separate them?
Yeah.
Would they allow them? I don't know. Or are they all sort of kind of secretly on the DL, like, sucking each other's dick?
Well, I didn't read the book, but I think if he put the women into a position where they were still seen, they're used as pilots, but still seen as more delicate than the men, I think it could follow that he would have a view of gay people that was with the times.
They are more delicate than the men, but that is also why they're better pilots. They're
more reactive and agile.
But my point is that it was still influenced by the culture of the time and their opinions of women, you know?
Right. So, exactly.
And he didn't even mention, you know, in a book about in a book that tries to at least push some kind of semblance of equality. He didn't even mention that, either because it wasn't a concern or...
Yeah, but it's been shown that women are actually more psychic than men. But
I'm talking about gay people, Mari.
I know, but like, women and gay people are also like,
gay
that's
people
what
can
I'm
be
saying.
Psychic
like,
too.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah, all right.
They're more in tune with their feminine side or masculine side.
I was saying is I'm more interested in the psychic core.
Well, Dingus is saying that because it wasn't brought up, then that just supports the status quo, which was negative.
Yeah, I was just answering a question.
And so we only can speculate about that, whereas it would have been great if that had been addressed in the novel in some creative way, in the same way other things were. But
they probably would have accused him of being a communist, and somebody would have called the McCarthy hotline on him.
Yeah, because he was a friend of other sexual libertines, and I doubt he had something against homosexuality.
Him knowing Jack Parsons, like, that's just amazing. Like, that was a good fact to learn.
Heinlein in public was very like, this is my wife and we are like, we're married and we're a couple. And then like behind the scenes, they were kind of swingers and had like an open relationship.
Probably a thalamite.
Or at least running in those circles. So if you'd like to hear us talk about how women and stuff were treated in Sparta and the Gnostic outlook in the novel, which we suspect Heinlein had as a friend of Jack Parsons and other occultists, then please subscribe at www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where $5 gets you all our extended episodes, a 5x5 vinyl sticker of our cover art, and access to our Discord server, where you can just hang out and talk to us the way we're talking now, and share memes and be a weirdo. Because we know you are, if you listen to this show.
It's mostly me talking to myself.
It's good stuff. It's worth your money, saying.
That's true, because we're all just mirrored perceptions inside of Dingus's mind, hired by gang-stalking CIA members to confound his life into false belief systems so we can harvest
his glands. Shut the fuck up, man. They'll hear you. God damn it.
Join the Discord so you can see your biscuits into other people's brains and suck out the stuff by asking questions.
Send me money. I got fucking laid off today after slaving away for this company for like months.
Yep, we got to keep his glands nice and healthy.
And if you want to have a girlfriend in Canada, you got to quit your fucking job and go through all this paperwork just to date somebody. So this is now my source of income. So do subscribe and join the Discord where you can send Dingus money.
It's totally worth it for the Discord.
Because I'm not paying him yet, but I want to.
Yeah.
It's the thought that counts.
Technically, this is an unpaid internship and now I don't have a job.
So remember, citizenship is an attitude, a state of mind, an emotional conviction that the whole is greater than the part, and that the part should be humbly proud to sacrifice itself that the whole may live. Thank you, everybody. Eat carrots, shoot lasers.
Pew, pew, pew.